welcome to episode 52 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here with my bibliophile friend, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hello, Perry. Yes, I suppose that's true. I am a bibliophile. I'm surrounded by books where I am at the moment, so I suppose that's a bit of an indication.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that we all... one of the burdens that we all share, I think, David, that we all end up collecting massive amounts of stuff that we don't know what to do with.
It's only a burden when you have to move house. It's a joy when you just own them and are surrounded by them.
When you have
to move house, it's not good.
Well, there is that that title of the book, Books Do Furnish Your Room, and they certainly do. They're just basically a backdrop of my life, mostly, since I was about 20, I think, so... Anyway, what have you been up to, David? Anything in particular?
I got the big jab on last Wednesday, or one of the first dose of the big jab anyway last Wednesday, COVID vaccine, AstraZeneca version of that. And I've got the other one coming the end of July, I think. It's a long while between them. It's about 12 weeks, I think.
12 weeks, yeah. But they're sort of saying that you can get up to, it sort of gives you an 80% chance of getting much more reduced symptoms
after the first jab, basically. The chance of death is far, far less once you've had any of the vaccines.
Well, I saw a report this morning from the UK where they're saying that if you get fully vaccinated, the chance of getting a fatal case is down by about 97%.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, I think there was always going to be some people that are going to unfortunately be caught out by it, but you know, it is certainly the way to go. I haven't quite got it yet. I'm eligible now and will be trying to arrange that for next week or the week after when I get back. I'm not wary about the idea of getting it. I had heard that some people weren't feeling very well after they had it. And because I'm away from home traveling at the moment, I didn't really want to...
Oh, no, you don't want to do that. No.
I didn't want to be feeling unwell when I was away. And that was the only thing that is holding me back. It's purely a matter of timing as opposed to getting it or not. I certainly will be getting it. I think it's one that I would recommend everybody do.
Encourage people to do, for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that it's the only way we're going to get over this thing and get back to any form of normality. But anyway, David, we should move on to the podcast. But there was one thing that I wanted to chat about first. As you'll probably be aware, I keep on bringing up information regarding awards in the SF&F field on a fairly regular basis. On this particular podcast, just to keep people appraised of what's happening and where we're up to. The most recent thing that I wanted to mention was that the Locus Awards have released their shortlists. These are the awards that are run by the Locus magazine, which styles itself as the newspaper of this genre. And it probably is. It basically covers pretty much everything that you could possibly hope to cover. Not everything, but you know, enough to be able to look at it as being a newspaper. It gives you lots of details about news and awards. But they also run their own awards themselves. They, a little while ago, a couple of months back in February, I think, and I believe I mentioned this on the podcast, they released their recommended reading list for the 2020 year based on their reviewers and critics all coming together, putting all their recommendations together, and then they come up with a full list of what's, in inverted commas, the best in the field. Now, as I also mentioned at that time, they have lots of different novel categories in the sense that they have a science fiction novel, a fantasy novel, horror novel, YA novel, and a first novel. Mm-hmm. And you could only be in one of those categories. And as I pointed out, for the last year in 2020, there were a lot of the best novels in the field were debut novels, so they're all up against each other in the first novel category and not in the science fiction novel. But not so much for 2020. But anyway, interesting to note that my favourite, Ministry of the Future, is by Kim Stanley Robinson, is there in the 10 entries, and they have 10 entries for the shortlist for each of their categories. It's in the science fiction novel. Of course, Piranesi by Susanna Clarke is in the fantasy novel. I'm really coming around, David, to thinking there's a good chance that the Clarke will be the big one for this year. I reckon it's going to, it just keeps cropping up all the time. It's
Oh, deservedly so. Deservedly so.
absolutely. But it's not in this particular field, it's not always a matter of whether you're the best or not. It's maybe sometimes a matter of whether you hit all the right notes that are required for this particular point in time for these awards. And this does both. It is the best and it hits all the notes. And I do think that there's a fairly damn good chance that it's going to pick up a Mozza. The also in the fantasy novel there is The Left-Handed Booksellers of London by Garth Nix, the Sydney author. I'm hoping to get to that at some point. Who knows when? And then it goes on and on for the first novels, novellas, novelettes, short stories, etc., etc., etc. There's a vast number. We will put the link to the finalists for that up on the show notes, so people can go and basically have a look at it. And just thought I'd let people know that that was there because I think it's one of the top three awards in the field, and I think that we need to keep note of it, and it gives you an idea about what's good in the field and what's recommended to be read. But that's about it for general matter, David. So I
All
think we
right, there we
might
go.
just we should
Well,
just move on.
we should just move on. Well, what we're moving on to is it's another episode. We haven't had one all year. Another episode of The Hugo Time Machine. Now, this we're looking at the Hugo Time Machine is visiting the year of 1966, I believe. So can you tell us, Perry, about where the Worldcon was that year and a bit about that?
Well, the 1966 Hugo Awards, of course, cover publications from the year of 1965. They were awarded at the 24th World Science Fiction Convention, held in Cleveland, Ohio. This was a convention called TriCon, held from the 1st to the 5th of September in 1966. The guest of honour was Earl Sprague de Camp. And the attendance was approximately 850. So, touch bigger than AussieCon in 75.
Not much, but a bit, yeah.
Not much bigger, but a bit. Though they start to build up quite a
Yeah.
lot from here on in. Now, the Hugo Awards at this time were still looking at two fiction awards and some others. So, they were dealing with the novel length and short fiction. And, so basically, they were the only ones there. However, the interesting thing about 1966 is that it was the first year in which the Nebula Awards were presented for works from 1965. The Nebula Awards are presented by the Science Fiction and Fantasy, well, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. This is an organisation of professionals within the field. They were originally called the Science Fiction Writers of America. It was then changed later to the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, but they still have the same acronym now of SFWA. So this was the very first year that the Nebulas, the second major big award in the field, were presented. Now, the Nebulas did something different from the Hugos in that they look a lot more modern in that they have four fiction categories. So exactly the same as we have now, that is novel, novella, novelette, and short story, the Nebula started straight away. The Hugos held out for a couple of years, and in a couple of years' time, and we'll get to those later this year or maybe early next year, depending on how our Hugo Time Machine schedule goes, they also moved to the four categories. So it's interesting that we can sort of compare and contrast to have a bit of a look at each. We're not going to dig deeply into the Nebula Awards for various reasons, which I will bring up when we get through to discuss the shorter fiction and the novels in more depth. But we will be mentioning whether a particular work won a Nebula Award as well as the Hugo Award as we go. So that's basically it, David. That it's an interesting thing to know that there's now there's another reward that we can check things with for the Hugos. But I thought we'd start off with the short fiction stuff first. There were five nominees for the short fiction category. This is anything less than a novel, and so it can cover anything from the short story all the way through to the novella. So basically anything less than 40,000 words fitted into this particular category. So do you want to kick us off with the
Yeah,
first one,
well,
David?
I mean, I just wanted to say too that it really makes much more sense to look at them the way that the Nebulas did, because here we're comparing, for this particular year in the Hugos, we're comparing quite a short story with things which are put into the magazines as short novels. And it's very hard to compare two things of those different sort of lengths.
It's chalk and cheese with these things, isn't it? I
Absolutely.
mean,
So, in fact,
yeah.
I am going to start with what was called a short novel. And that's, these days, we probably call it a novella. But that's Mark and Reprisal by Poul Anderson. I'm not sure how to pronounce Poul Anderson's name, but Poul Anderson, Poul. This story fits into the category of military SF, I think, which Poul Anderson was obviously fond of. You might recall that when we last discussed the, well, sorry, when we discussed the Hugos for 1964, his novella No Truce with Kings won the short fiction Hugo in that year. And that was a military sort of story, military SF sort of story. Anyway, in this one, Mark and Reprisal, there's not actually a lot of actual fighting in it. There's more a lot of political maneuvering. So the background is that humanity has come into contact with an alien race called the Aluriona, who have been around for many millennia longer than humans have. And so far, relations have been fairly cordial, and there's an Aluriona ambassador on Earth and a human one on their planet. But as humanity has been colonizing planets around other stars, the spheres of influence of these two races have started to intersect, and there have been some skirmishes between them. So, as the story opens, there's been, in fact, a deadly conflict over a planet that humans have named New Europe. The Illyrianans claim that they were attacked by the humans living there, unprovoked, because apparently the humans misunderstood the intentions of a passing Illyrian fleet. The Illyrianans were forced to respond with nuclear missiles, and they now say that all the humans on New Europe were killed. Oh dear, very sorry. So, the protagonist of the story is one Gunnar Heim, who is apparently the wealthy owner of a major corporation making nuclear engines for starships. Think Elon Musk. At the beginning of the story, he's going from bar to bar trying to track down a guy called Vadas. Vadasz, a Hungarian who's become, get this, a travelling minstrel, wandering from star to star. And so we get lots of drunken singing at the start. And there's quite a nice song he sings at the beginning, which has got French lyrics and maybe genuine, I guess, maybe an original song. But the rest of the songs that he sings throughout the story are very, very banal things with very clumsy lyrics. There seems to be this thing with SF writers who seem to think that they can write songs or write poetry, and it's generally not well advised. Robert Heinlein was particularly bad at this sort of thing, and Poul Anderson isn't much better. Anyway, he catches up with this guy, Vadas, who claims to have evidence that there are still millions of humans alive on New Europe. They weren't all killed, but they've retreated to the hills while the Illyrianas have come in to occupy the cities. Gunnar Heim believes him and starts to campaign to the authorities to not just accept this story and abandon the humans and cede the planet to the aliens. And it gets a lot of pushback, particularly from a Senator Twyman, who fears creating an all-out war with Illyriana, which he thinks that the Earth would lose. Now, at this point, I realize that this is absolutely based on a template. It's basically the basic story is from the situation in Europe in the late 1930s. So for Illyriana, read Hitler's Germany. For New Europe, read the Sudeten territory of Czechoslovakia. And Gunnar Heim is playing the Winston Churchill, demanding that Germany be stopped, while Senator Twyman is playing Neville Chamberlain, willing to appease Germany by concessions at the Munich Conference of 1938. So Haim is arguing that if they abandon the humans on New Europe, Illyriana would take that as a signal that they can continue to be aggressive and seize more human territory, whereas Twyman and the Terran government just want peace in our time. So I'm not sure what putting all that historical situation into space actually adds to the story, but I guess it's interesting enough, and maybe it is a kind of universal situation you might get into. Anyway, we then get a bit of additional drama when Haim's daughter Lisa she's a teenage girl. She's kidnapped by a group of pacifists who are alarmed by Gunnar Haim's pushing for this harsh response to Illyriana. And they demand that he declare that the evidence that Vadaz had for remaining human presence on New Europe, they want him to declare that's all been forged, and they want him to abandon his push for a military mission to rescue the humans there. So then there's a bit of action because Lisa's been kidnapped when Haim and Vadaz kidnap the Illyrianan ambassador in turn and use him as leverage to free Lisa, because they figure that if they kill the ambassador, Illyriana will definitely declare war, and that scares off their peaceniks, and they release the girl. Now, Haim manages to get support for his views from the French government. Even though Earth's got the central government, there's these individual nations still which still have their own authority. And with the French, they build up this legal framework by which the French will commission Haim to act as a privateer. Now, a privateer is essentially a pirate acting with covert approval from some country or a nation. As a pirate, he would harass Illyrianan commerce in space, cut their supply lines and so on. And Haim uses his immense wealth to buy up a starship, secretly equip it as a warship, and he starts signing up a crew, including Vadaz, who apparently can do more than just sing rousing songs. Obviously, if his plans become known, the Terran government would try to stop him, so it all happens undercover. And there's a big scramble for him to launch the ship and head off into interstellar space before the French are forced to reveal their approach and announce that they've granted Haim letters of marque and reprisal, which is a sort of formal commission to go out and be a privateer. So Haim escapes in the nick of time, and that's where the story comes to an end. I imagine that there were follow-up stories which describe Haim's activities as an outer space pirate, I'd be very surprised if in those stories it doesn't turn out that Haim's teenage daughter Lisa hasn't stowed away to be part of the action in order to be close to Vadaz, whom she started to develop a crush on. I could be wrong about that. Anyway, look, this is okay. It was entertaining enough. It wasn't a standout. Don't think it would have deserved to win the award. What do you think of it?
Oh, yeah, look, I thought it was rather thin. There wasn't really a lot of interest there. You're correct about the fact that it was part of a series. This was originally published in Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction in February 1965. There were two other novellas in this series also published in that magazine in the year, and they were then fixed up into a novel called The Star Fox.
The Star Fox, okay.
Which will be mentioned again later on in this podcast. So basically he just split his novel into three novellas.
Mm. Sounds familiar.
It does. It's sort of like, you know, it's not... You'd almost think that it's would have been better off to do as installments, but anyway, I don't know. That's the way they decided they were going to do it.
Sure.
Yeah. Look, I thought this was pretty thin, because it just reads like the first part of a novel, and it suffers because of that, because it just doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, it doesn't go anywhere. What's the point?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Now we're off. Okay. Start. Yeah, you know. Right. And he's like, why pick this out of the three, or why pick this out of any?
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a heck of a lot more better stuff that was published in 1965 than this.
Sure.
But, you know, Anderson was sort of flavour of the that time. You know, as you said, he won a Hugo Award for a sort of a similar military political novel earlier. You know, it's very much pushing... a libertarian line that he did with the other one as well. So, you know, maybe that's what they all loved at that time, because well, Heinlein was top of the pops at that point,
sure.
And he was very much along that line. So anyway, I only gave it 2.8 out of 5. I didn't really think it was all that right. Flash. Yeah. So anyway, my first one is a novella by Fritz Leiber called Star Dock. This was originally published in Fantastic in September 1965. Now, it's one of Leiber's Farfadet and the Grey Mouser, Farfadet and the Grey Mouser sword and sorcery stories. Too many S's in there, David. I get a little bit, the tongue just runs away. Now, these are generally pretty good. Basically, companions on the road sort of stuff. Farfadet's the strong swordsman. Grey Mouser is the burglar, if you like, and he's sort of the large and the tall versions of these two companions. And so they're rather odd companions that have a number of adventures. I think there was probably something like four or five collections of short stories,
Yeah, I
so
think so. Yeah,
20, maybe
lots.
30 stories in this whole series. So it's quite well known. Look, all good readable stuff. In this one, the two of them have heard that there's a treasure to be found on the top of the mountain called Stardock, the highest peak of the mountains of the giants in the cold waste region of Naiwan. Now, Nawon, Nehwon, is of course Nowen spelt backwards. Very tricksy, that one. Now, these two, accompanied by their newly acquired ice cat Harissa, set out to climb the mountain because they want to basically try and get up there and get to the treasure. And along the way, they're attacked by a snow serpent and another pair of climbers also searching for the treasure. Interesting that nobody's ever found it, but there happens to be two sets of climbers going up at about the same time. It's a rather lightweight sort of adventure story, more of the same from Library. I mean, if you really like the Farfadet and the Grey Mouse and stuff, you'll probably think this is great, but I don't think it adds anything particularly new to the genre. I enjoyed it. I gave it 3.3 out of 5. It's quite a pleasant story, but you look at it and you think, given the way SF was changing at this point, and we'll get more, and you'll see more of that coming up. I mean, you're getting people like Zelazny and Ellison and other people starting to come in. You're getting Ballard starting to arrive, and there's a changeover happening here that you can see through the whole of the genre. And we're harking back to something which could really have been written 15 years previously and would be just as good. And hasn't really progressed the field very far. I like it. I'm not going to criticize the story because of that. I just don't think it was the best story, and I don't think it should have been on the ballot. And in fact, it is not the best Fritz Leiber story from 1965. I've been doing quite a lot of reading in that particular short fiction in that particular year for an article that I'm writing. And this is not his best work from that particular year, which. So it's just odd that he picked it up. Other people's views may vary, but pretty much more of the standard stuff, David, I think.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a the Hugos were a popular award, or are a popular award, and so if people, maybe he just has a big following for that particular line of stories, that could be it.
That way may well be the case. And look, I don't want to denigrate Leiber's work in this particular field, in the sword and sorcery story field, because basically his stuff was, it's he writes very well. It's very competent. We've discussed some of his fantasy previously and also some of his science fiction. I think he's far better in the fantastic side of the thing rather than in the science fiction technical side, which I don't really think he handles as well as the other. I think he's better off if he deals with sort of that paranormal metaphysical stuff. This is at one end. This is the sort of adventure sword and sorcery stuff. And if you take the pieces that he does in the middle, which are sort of like those stories, a bit like Shirley Jackson that you've been talking about. They on the face of them they read like almost a straight realistic story, but then there's just a little bit of the metaphysical or the supernatural into them, and it just makes it that little bit better, the story. He's very good at that sort of stuff. This is not the top of his work, still competent, and I would heartily recommend that people read the Farfadet and the Grey Mouser stories, but you've got to like sword and sorcery stuff.
You've got to like it, yeah.
If you're a straight SF fan, forget all about it.
It doesn't appeal to me, I'm afraid.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. All right. So my next story, we've talked a bit about seeing all these novellas, which are actually part of a longer-running novel or a longer-running series, and that's certainly been the case with this particular Hugo year. So I'm going to talk about a story, a novella, a short novel, whatever you like, called The Day of the Great Shout by Philip Jose Farmer. I think it's a terrible title, The Day of the Great Shout. It's a particularly terrible title considering how really nice the name of the title for the novel version was, which is To Your Scattered Bodies But Go. I just wonder whether Farmer was lucky enough to have a good editor at the publishers of the novel who knew her John Donne and chose that title for him. Seems like it to me. Anyway, setting that aside, this short novel here in the magazine is called The Day of the Great Shout. So the basic plot, we'll just cover the basic plot of the story, of the idea. The basic plot is that at the beginning of the story, we have this unnamed protagonist. It's all written in the third person. And this unnamed individual is aware that he has died, or that at least that when he was last conscious, he was in the process of dying. But he wakes up and he finds himself floating in space, slowly rotating like a chicken on a spit, I suppose. And around him, thousands of other human beings, all naked, are similarly floating in this vast grid in space. He's the only one who's awake, and he tries to struggle out of some sort of confinement he's in and tries to reach a nearby rod of metal. And when he grabs hold of it, all of the other bodies begin to fall from where to where. I'm really not sure about that. And then some sort of vehicle approaches him and they zap him unconscious again. He then has a dream where he's talking to God, who is demanding payment. You owe for the flesh, God says. And then finally the protagonist wakes up again to find himself this time lying on grass on the banks of a wide river. So he's surrounded by many other naked humans, as well as one apparently alien being. They all begin to wake up, and many of these people are absolutely in total shock because they find themselves alive again, but they're not in what seems to be either heaven or hell. It doesn't match up with any of their religions. And these people who discover seem to have lived in a variety of different historical periods of time, including periods after he himself died. Now, Farmer's protagonist, we eventually discover, is none other than Richard Francis Burton, who in real life was a fascinating character. He was a Victorian-era explorer who sought the sources of the Nile and discovered Lake Tanganyika. Well, he discovered it for Europeans anyway. I'm sure the Africans have known about it for quite some time. He was a man who travelled in disguise as an Arab to the holy Islamic cities of Mecca and Medina. He translated the 101 Nights into English, complete with all the naughty bits. He was a really remarkable individual. But you get the impression that while Farmer has done some research into Burton, I didn't at all get the sense that he had much insight into the way that Burton would really have thought and looked at the world. To me, Farmer's character is just an unremarkable run-of-the-mill adventure hero. Be that as it may, Burton gathers around him a group of supporters, including the alien and a Neanderthal. And also included in the group is the adult Alice Liddell, who as a child was the model for Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. Alice, rather improbably, eventually becomes Burton's lover. Burton organises this group to investigate their surroundings, and they discover useful resources, including stands of bamboo. And with these, he and his group build a boat and set off up the river and have a series of adventures, including being captured by one Hermann Göring, who has made himself the head of a group controlling a number of slaves, many of whom are Jews. Now, Burton helps the slaves break out of their compound, and Göring, of course, comes to a nasty end. Burton heads off again, determined to find the source of the Nile, the source of the river, and demand answers from the creators of the river world. Look, I always thought that the basic concept here is a really good, a really interesting one. The idea that every person who's ever been born on Earth is going to be resurrected by some advanced technology. And you mix people from all these different eras together and, you know, you enable really potentially interesting interactions between major historical figures who in real life lived in very different times, but here are brought together in this resurrected world. Great concept. The problem is that Farmer really turns this exciting idea into something which is, you know, pretty dull, at least here in this novella version. The novel, if I remember rightly, expands on the idea a bit, which does help. But then each succeeding novel in the series, which I think is five, six books long, it really gets less and less interesting to me. So it's okay, not a bad story as a standalone story. Interest, certainly interesting concept, which is one thing you can say about it. What do you think of it?
Yeah, the same. I think it's an interesting concept. It starts off really well, and then it's, oh, I don't know, it just seems to get a little bit plodding to
It's
me.
when they get into the boat and start going up a river, and days and days and days pass by, and it just becomes another road novel.
We should actually point out that this river appears to be literally endless.
Yes.
It just goes on and on and on forever. This is not a what we would look on as being a standard physical construct. It just goes on forever. And they come across different peoples camped on the side of the river in different sort of enclaves. And it's look, as you said, it starts off. It is an interesting concept. The author's novel, To Your Scattered Bodies Go, which, as you say, is a fantastic title because it fits this beautifully. That particular novel is made up of this novella and another one called The Suicide Express.
Oh,
Well,
yes, I remember. Yeah,
that's another great title. So yes, I think you're probably right. I think the
had a good editor.
publisher may well have come up with the title, because if Farmer was the one doing this, yeah, not so good. I think this is a case of read the final novel better than to read this. Again, it's another one of these ones where you go, well, actually, I could almost see this one making the shortlist for the ballot, because it's a very, very interesting, strange concept,
Yeah,
and
it's original. It's original.
it's also a tad risque here. You've got to remember. I mean, there's a lot of people here that are in the nutty most of the time, and Richard Burton's basically, having an affair with Alice Little. So Alice Little, this is a bit risque, and it may well have appealed to a few people when they thought, ooh, this is a bit out
Maybe.
there. From our perspective, sort of, what is it, 55 years later? No, it's not out there at all. But it's interesting. But read the novel. In my view, that's really about the best you can do, I think.
But don't bother with the sequels.
No, I think it just ran out of gas after the first one, as I
The
recall. But I'd.
second one's not bad, but it gets worse from there on.
Oh, okay. I think I've only read the first one, which is a.
The next one is called The Fabulous Riverboat, and it features Mark Twain.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes, that's
Oh,
right.
Sam Clemens, who builds a riverboat, a paddle wheel riverboat to go up.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. And this one's actually a novelette by Roger Zelazny. And we were talking about titles earlier in terms of who chooses them, what they do. Well, hopefully Zelazny was the one that chose this one, because it is a cracker of a title, I
Yeah, it
think.
is nice.
This is The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth. That's a wonderful title. And you look at it and you think, what? No idea what this could be about. Now, I should point out that this actually was the winner of the 1966 Debut Award for Best Novelette. So we will go to that further on, but I'll just mention that as we go.
Sure.
This was published in Fantasy and Science Fiction in March 1965. F and SF were doing some damn good stuff in that particular year, or around that particular era. There's a bit of stuff here that, and this one in particular is good. I really like this one. And this is an entry in that odd little subgenre of science fiction stories called the alternate Venus stories. This is where Venus is cloud covered, hot, watery, but ultimately habitable. It sort of looks like, well, it's just like Earth on a hot, humid day. And so people looked at that from a perspective, it's covered in cloud, it must have a lot of rain. It's about the same size as the Earth, so it's probably got the same sort of climate. Bit hotter, lots of oceans. So basically, if it's got lots of oceans, it must have lots of fish and sea-going creatures in it. And that's what this whole story is about. Carlton Davitz is a fisherman who's obsessed with landing the largest water creature on Venus. This is a 100-meter-long monster. Massively long, huge thing, and he's attempted this in the past, to be able to try and land this particular creature when the story starts. He's lost a fortune in his own attempt and has now been hired by Jean Luharich, I'm not sure if that's how it's pronounced, who's a super rich cosmetics model. And the two have some romantic history of the past, of course.
Of course.
And she's hired him to go and basically try and catch this particular creature. Now, the story follows the straightforward account of the hunt, but it's told in typical sparkling style by Zelazny. You know, there's always things going on. The main character's a bit of a wisecracker, as we'll come across with some other things later on in this podcast by Zelazny. He's that sort of there's a touch of the, you know, sort of film noirish PI guy here all the time. You know, he's always cracking wise. He's always got a bit of repartee. And I remember when Zelazny was in Australia in 1978, he actually said that somebody asked him at one stage of one of the panels he was on at, it was Unicon 4, he was at the National Convention that year in 1978. They asked him, "So what happens when your character, you know, when you don't really know what to do?" And he said, I write my character exactly the same way as I do myself. I sit back and light a cigarette and, oh yeah, so he just types that up and off he goes. And then he figures out what happens. And this guy does this a lot. He just stops, doesn't know really what to do, lights a cigarette and off he goes. It's standard sort of stuff for Zelazny. Now, if you think about this particular story in terms of how it all comes together and you look at the particular character that he's going through, because he's a heavy drinker, he started high, he was well-known and well-renowned in his field, and then he crashed because he had a massive failure, took to drinking, and now he's trying to get himself back up again to be where he was before. This is a great white hunter type of story told in an SF setting. And that would generally have made it fairly sort of, you know, ho-hum and drum and boring. But Zelazny's written it. And so it's got a bit of verve to it. And I don't think this falls into some of those other problems that you mentioned with Rose for Ecclesiastes in particular when we discussed that, in that it's not attempting to be so sparkling because he's just trying to put all the highbrow stuff in to say, "Oh, look how clever I am as a writer." He's just taken this particular story and he's put his verve into it and his sparkle into it. And it's brought the whole basic plot and story up to another level. And this would be one of the ones that you would look at as being in the top echelon of any Zelazny stories that you would want to put together. I think Rose for Ecclesiastes is in there as well, although you have different points of view. But I.
It's not bad, but I just
No, I understand, but I.
to use a phrase which was coined, I think, by John Siracusa, who's a podcaster I listen to, nothing is so perfect that it can't be criticized. And we'll come across that later on when I'm talking about some of the other books in this podcast.
Absolutely. There's always some things that you can say about. I like this story. I think it's as it fits. It's not one of the all-time great SF stories ever written, but it's up in an echelon which is probably a little bit below that. I think it was definitely reasonable that it should have appeared on the Hugo ballot. And as I said, it won the Nebula Award for best novelette. I gave it 4.2 out of 5. I
Okay.
enjoy this story. I really enjoy it.
Fine. All right. What am I going on to? Oh, right. Now we go on to Repent, this one. All right.
Yep, the winner.
Right. The winner. Interesting. So the title is Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man. Great title.
Yep, it
Great
is. I mean,
title.
there's two good titles in a row. I mean, this is a really that's an excellent title. Harlan Ellison, who wrote this, actually did come up with some damn good titles as well.
Good title.
Yep.
That's about it for me.
Oh, okay.
No,
Is that all
no, no,
right?
no, 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 no. I will go on and talk about it.
All right.
So this is quite a short story, so it's very hard to compare these with some of the longer works. It seems to be very highly regarded. I'll grant you that. And it won all these awards, it won the Hugo and Nebula Awards. But for the life of me, I can't see why. It seems to be a very slight story to me. So we'll discuss it. Perry's going to disagree with me on this one, I'm sure. So the story is set in the relatively near future, when society has become more and more organized, so much so that everything has to happen just at the right time for society to run smoothly. Workers need to turn up promptly for their shifts. They need to knock off precisely on time, get home exactly on time. So the machine has to be kept functioning smoothly. And in order to make sure that all this happens, a powerful office has been established to ensure punctuality, led by the master timekeeper. That's his official title, but unofficially he's known as the TikTok man, and he has the power of life and death. If a member of society is late for some occasion, then the amount of time lost is taken off that individual's lifespan. If you're 10 minutes late for your shift or half an hour late for a social occasion, then that amount of time is taken off your expected lifespan. Lose enough time and the TikTok man sends out a signal to a cardiac device that everybody has to wear, and they die instantly. So now into this smoothly running machine, Ellison introduces some grit in the form of a renegade known only as Harlequin, who dresses up in a jester suit and flies about creating mayhem. At one point, he spills out tens of thousands of jelly beans over a shift heading home from work on a moving slidewalk, creating a great deal of hilarity, but also a great deal of chaos and delaying the return home of the workers by an enormous 7 minutes. This delay has knock-on effects. Quotas are missed. Supplies do not turn up on time. Manufacturing is slowed, creating further delays. The Harlequin clearly must be stopped, but no one knows who he is. The TikTok man can't send out this lethal signal until he knows who to send it to. So Ellison then gives us a semi-plausible history of how this obsession with punctuality arose and how it's taken over society. And eventually, of course, the Harlequin is caught and he's been betrayed by his wife, who's sick of him always being late for events, and she desperately wants him to conform. So he's arrested and he's taken before the TikTok man. "Repent, Harlequin," says the TikTok man. And the Harlequin responds, "Get stuffed." But instead of killing him, they decide to use him as a cautionary tale, and he is sent off to be brainwashed, returning to tell everyone on television how important it is to be a conformist and to always be on time. Except, despite all of that, somehow the Harlequin has succeeded in creating a permanent disturbance in the world, and as the story ends, the TikTok man himself is running late. Look, I thought this was amusing, not very deep. It's an amusing think piece, but the characters have no depth. They're just symbols for ideas rather than real people. But won all those awards, so it might just be me. I don't know. I didn't mind it. I liked it, but I didn't think it was award-winning stuff.
Now, well, as you point out, it also won the Nebula Award for Best Short Story, and I think it's a triumph of form over content.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that basically, Ellison just came in like a bulldozer through the middle of the field with some of these stories, and he was just so different from everybody else.
No, it's original. Yeah.
It is original. Well, original to a degree. See, I look at this as being a variant on Orwell's 1984, where the master timekeeper is Ellison's big brother, and the Harlequin is Winston Smith.
Yeah, well, he actually references 1984 toward the end of the story, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And so you basically get this and you sort of think, well, yeah, okay, so this is his variant of it. But as you say, it's short. It's thin. There's not a lot to it. And you sort of think, well, this must have caused a big lot of ructions in the SF field when it came out. Interestingly, it was published in Galaxy. Mm-hmm. So that was edited by Fred Pohl around that time, I believe.
Okay, yeah.
And so it doesn't even appear as the cover story for that particular issue, by the way.
No.
It's just listed on the front of Ellison is just listed as one of the contributors on the front of the front of the magazine. I think that you would probably find that a lot of people in the field would consider this to be one of the all-time great stories written in the field. I don't. I only give this a 4.0 out of 5. It's got a lot of good things going for it, but as you say, it's short and it's thin.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So anyway, so that's interesting that it won over the others, but when you look at the others that are there, in the short fiction, Mark and Reprisal by Paul Anderson, Day of the
Yeah, what
Rat
would you have
Chow.
given it to? I think it.
I probably would have given it to the Zelazny myself.
Yeah, well, I unfortunately didn't get around to reading that. So, but yeah, it sounds like it. Sounds like it. Yeah, it should have been the winner.
But I'm working on something else for an article that I'm going to be published sometime in the next few months, looking at things all the way across the board. And I don't think it was the best short story published that year either. So, but people will find
Oh,
out about
interesting,
that.
interesting.
Now, the thing that we have to remember for the Nebula Awards, David, is that they were presented by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. The restrictions on them were that they had to be published in the year in question, that is in 1965, in English in the United States. That basically meant that anything that was published in the UK, Europe, or anywhere else was ineligible for the awards.
Yeah.
And so while we think of the Nebulas as being a big, the big, well, one of the big two awards for the year, we have to take into account the fact that they didn't include anything from the UK. Now, when you actually get to the Nebula winners, you find that there is, in the particular categories, you'll hear that there are some United Kingdom authors here, but they publish their stories
In the US.
in the US. So anyway, so if we go and look at now the other thing also is that with the Hugo Award, they had five nominees on the ballot. The novella, because this was the first year and they were still trying to work out how they were going to run the prize and what they were going to do about it, they had a ballot and they included every story that had received one nomination during the
Ah,
year.
crikey.
So there's a lot, there's a quite a quite a lot of stuff. In the novella category for the Nebulas, there were eight nominees, which is a lot. Two winners. The two winners were The Saliva Tree by Brian W. Aldiss. That was a he's a UK writer, published in Fantasy and Science Fiction, September 1965, and Roger Zelazny again for He Who Shapes, which was published in Amazing in January to February 1965. That He Who Shapes was later expanded into the novel The Dream Master. Now, I don't think we need to go into these very deeply, but did you read any of these,
No,
David?
I didn't. I was running short of time to read it.
No, that's okay. Well, The Saliva Tree is Aldiss's homage to the SF of H.G. Wells. And, it's good story. I really quite liked it. He Who Shapes is Zelazny's bit about being. He's sort of invented the science of neuroparticipation, where a psychiatrist can enter the dreams of somebody to be able to determine what's causing all their problems and being able to try and fix that.
Shades of Inception.
Yes, basically. Look, I think if I was to pick between the two, I would go for The Saliva Tree. I think that's probably the best of these two, but that's the way that goes. But both worthwhile reading, I think. The novelette, 19 nominees here, so it's starting to build up a fair bit. Now, don't forget the short story, the categories here, and the lengths of the stories go that short stories is up to 7,500, novelette is 7,500 to 17,500, novella is 17,500 to 40,000, and after that it becomes a novel. So this is the 7,500 to 14,500 to 17,500 word category for the novelette. 19 of them. The winner was The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth, and I don't have any problem with that at all. I think that's, pretty reasonable. The short stories, there were 31 nominees. Again, Ellison won this, so there was quite a lot of nominees. Of the ones that were nominated, it's probably as good as any of the others there. I think that. I'm still working my way through all the short stories that I need to read. There's quite a lot of them.
Yes.
Even if I do a long list and cut it back down again, there's still quite a lot of these that I need to get through. Look, I can certainly understand why Ellison won those two big awards, and that really kicked him off because this was the first time that he had ever actually appeared either on, had even appeared on the ballot. So for him to come in and just basically bang, win two big awards for short stories, and that sort of kicked him off to stay on that sort of short story run pretty much all the way right through. So I think that pretty much covers the short story stuff. We could go into a lot of the possible nominees, but
it'll take us forever.
So that moves us on to the novel for the Hugo. Again, there were five nominees in this particular category. I'll look at the first one. If you like, David, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. This is this was by Robert A. Heinlein. Published as a serial in Worlds of If, starting in December 1965 and running through to April 1966. Oddly enough, this particular book is actually the winner of the 1966 Hugo Award for Best Novel, so we won't go into it too deeply. This
we'll
is a
talk
bit
about
of a,
it next time, yeah.
Yeah, this is a bit of a weird one in the sense that I think that it was allowed to get onto the ballot stupidly, should not have been allowed, because it had one installment in 1965. My view is a novel's a novel when it's finished, and that should have not been accepted. It should have gone through to the 67 one, which it does. Anyway, this is, as I said, we'll basically deal with this in more depth later on. This is another one of Heinlein's libertarian style novels where he pushes his political views. It's set on the moon, where the moon has basically been set up as a penal colony run by the authority. You get sent there, you stay there, and you don't come back. The authority is run by, headed up by the warden, although the Earth authorities don't like him being called that, but that's what he is. Basically, once you're on the moon, you're there. You can do whatever you want, and they basically try to be self-governing as much as they possibly can. This is really Heinlein's version of shifting the convict Australia through to the moon and seeing what happens. He pushes his libertarian line that everything will be self-regulating because if you beat somebody up, his mates will come around and beat you up and that'll be the end of it. Mm. Well, human nature doesn't work like that.
That's right.
It just doesn't work like that. If if somebody gets killed, you don't just sort of stand by and go, oh, well, you did the wrong thing. Therefore, they're going to come over and going to kill you and that'll be the end of it and everything will be finished and then we'll just move on. No, it doesn't work. Anyway, so it's just a bit weird. He's got this libertarian idea that it's along the same lines as, well, if everybody's got a gun, nobody will use one because they'll be too scared to use it in terms of the reprisals.
Well,
that's really worked out, hasn't it? Let's think of a country where that everybody's got guns and they've got more guns than they know what to do with, and let's think of that. Oh yeah, they don't have any killings at all. No, that just doesn't work. I mean, this is look, it's in terms of the novel itself, it's a pretty good novel. I really quite enjoyed this. I enjoyed the whole thing all the way right through. But you've always got in the back of your head, there's somebody hitting you with a brick saying, just keep being aware of the fact that Heinlein's pushing his point of view here. Now, this for me, this is a pivot point for Heinlein. It's the best of his... the last best book I think he probably wrote. I think after this, he just really goes downhill. I mean, I wasn't keen on Strange in the Strange Land. This is a bit up. I certainly wasn't keen on Glory Road, as I've mentioned a number of times. This is up a little bit, but not enough to basically drag him all the way right up. I'd give this a 3.4 out of 5.
Of all of Heinlein's novels, it's probably the one I like the most. And it's got some interesting things in it. I like the bit where there's a rebellion basically, and the Earth the Moon people start to bomb the Earth with these cargoes of grain, literally, without slowing them down. And there's all these people in America who think, we're going to get out there, rah, 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 we're just going to have a picnic where they're going to say they're going to drop this thing. How harmful can it be? Yeah, and then they get blown up. That's one thing I remember very well out of the thing. Anyway, all right, so I'll move on.
Yep, do that, please. Please move on.
I'll move on. So I'm going to talk about a book called The Squares of the City by John Brunner. Now, the first question I've got, what's it doing being nominated for a science fiction award? Because as far as I can see, other than the fact that it has a slightly unlikely premise and that it's set in a fictional country, it's not science fiction at all. It reads more like a sort of low-energy thriller, and I actually found it very tedious. It's really hard to push through. Anyway, let's discuss it. It's written in the first person from the point of view of Boyd Hacklett, and that's spelt H-A-K-L-U-Y-T, which is a Norwegian name, but I believe it's pronounced Hacklett if it's an American or British surname. So he's a British traffic analyst. He specializes in how to get cars moving faster, how to avoid creating traffic jams, how to prevent too many passengers leaving a railway station at the same time, that sort of thing. He's an analyst in that sort of thing. And he's been awarded a contract to work on the problems of the Ciudad de Vados, which is in the country of Aguazul, somewhere in South America, fictional country of Aguazul. And the city has only been constructed a few years ago. It's been built on a virgin site as the proud new capital of the country, rather like Canberra or Brasilia. And it's been named after the country's current president, Juan Sebastian Vados. It doesn't take long before Hacklett realizes that his job isn't going to be as straightforward as he thought. And the president really wants him to find a way of clearing the city of undesirables, for instance, by getting rid of an ugly slum which has grown up beneath the fancy new metro station. It's filled with poor peasants who have flocked to the new city in hope of better prospects. All sorts of vice are reputed to thrive in the slum. But Hacklett can't see any actual traffic problem which would require this place to be cleared, and he tries to stick to his professional principles, but he comes under enormous pressure to comply with what the government wants. So Hacklett encounters a good-looking middle-aged woman called Maria Posador in the hotel where he's staying. He first meets her when she's playing chess with an opponent at one of the many chess tables scattered around the lobby. And it turns out that chess is the national sport and obsession there, just as it is in Russia. So Hacklett strikes up a conversation with her, and when she discovers who he is and what his role is, she warns him of the complexities of the country. There are all sorts of undercurrents running beneath the scenes and political machinations from both right and left. There's a strong political rivalry going on between President Vados and the Minister for the Interior, Diaz. There's a tension between the poor, native, largely dark-skinned population and the wealthier people, many of whom came to Aguazul from other places to act as advisors and to help construct the new city, but have now become citizens. So the plot's far too complex to explain in any detail, but the tensions in the city begin to rise and become more and more obvious. Many major characters that Hacklett becomes involved with end up being killed or disgraced or commit suicide. And Hacklett gets to the point where he's desperate to leave, though he doesn't want to ruin his reputation by openly breaking his contract. And then ultimately the life of Hacklett himself is threatened. One night he's drugged and dumped in a building on the grounds of the house where Maria Posador lives, and he's locked in. And Posador, who doesn't know about this, comes to investigate a noise there, and she's armed with a gun, and she comes very close to shooting Hacklett because she thinks he's an intruder. He survives, however, and goes off to confront Vados, the president, who Hacklett believes is behind much of what has been going on, as indeed he was. Finally, we discover, this is the big revelation, that Vados and Diaz have been trying to manipulate the various characters as though they were pieces on a chessboard, using statistical theories of human behavior. And the deaths and disablements of these characters represent the pieces being taken in this game of chess. So this is a pretty wacky idea, but it doesn't require any actual science fiction or fantasy in the story to implement what these politicians are doing. And in fact, their attempts to manipulate people as though they were mindless pieces in a game of chess don't actually work out very well anyway. And towards the end, things are completely out of control in the city. And as Hacklett leaves in a helicopter, the city is in flames. So it's not really science fiction at all, more of a political thriller with this kind of bizarre twist at the end of the thing. And to me, it takes a long, tedious while to get anywhere. It was a real struggle for me to finish it. Didn't like it much.
I haven't read it yet. I seem to recall.
I wouldn't waste your time.
I seem to recall reading it a long time ago, but I didn't get to it in the lead up to this.
Tedious. Yeah, it really is tedious.
Yeah, or maybe they just nominated because Brunner was considered to be a science fiction writer.
Yeah,
So
I mean,
I don't
it's
know.
a vaguely science fictional idea of an ideal city and human beings being controlled, but they're only controlled by, political manipulations. They're not controlled by some machine or magic wand or anything. It's just there's no fantasy in it.
Well, Brunner, not long after this, actually moved into a very productive and innovative phase where he wrote, three or four fantastic novels. Stand on
Stand on
Zanzibar,
Zanzibar was very good, yeah.
Jagged Orbit, Sheep Look Up, all this sort of stuff. And maybe this is his sort of transitional
Yeah,
book
maybe.
between the stuff that he would the sort of standard run-of-the-mill science fiction stuff he'd been writing in the late 50s, early 60s, and before he transitioned into writing these other ones, which we'll be coming to later on.
Yeah.
Interesting. Not sure. My next one is Skylark Duquesne
Ooh.
by E.E. Doc Smith.
Wow.
Well, what can I say about this book?
I don't know what we can say about it.
This is the fourth book in the Skylark series. He also wrote the Lensman stuff from, 1910s through to the 1930s. First one that I've read, and it will be the last.
I'm not surprised.
Mark Duquesne, the villain of the previous books for the Skylark series, has now matured and reformed and has been offered the chance to help Dick Seaton. And of course, it's mentioned that Dick Seaton and Mark Duquesne are the two baddest guys in the galaxy. Absolutely baddest, almost baddest guys in the universe. Dear. It's hard to talk about this book without being really completely and utterly dismissive. And this is a type of science fiction that was written in the 1910s and the 1920s, which I just don't like.
So what's it doing being published in the 1960s? That's my question.
This is the question. In fact, I'll just give a brief run through and then I'll just dismiss it pretty quickly, I
Okay,
think.
sure.
So the novel deals with the interactions between the two of these two blokes and an alien race known as the Chlorons, Chlorans. Chlorans. Now, these aliens that are attempting to escape from their own galaxy. Wow.
Okay.
How about that? And they want to take over the universe. The whole universe, not just the galaxy, the whole bloody universe, David. And they want to enslave humans in the process. Now, of course, our two heroes decide they don't really want to do this. And so they get together and they undertake to carry out an act of genocide, as you do, by destroying their whole entire galaxy,
Oh my goodness.
suns, planets, everything, the whole bloody lot. And everybody lives happily ever after. It's fantastic. Oh God. Now, this was published just before Smith died. So he died before the end of 1965. And so you really have to think that this Hugo nomination was more an emotional one rather than a logical one. It is a very, very, very poor book. I absolutely and utterly struggled through this. I just could not stand it. There's bits and pieces all over the place where you go, oh no. Oh, no. It was just harks back to
A different era, yeah.
a different era of stuff, the science fiction that was written for 12 to 15-year-olds, and that was really it. Now, some people really like this stuff, and that's fine, but it's just not what I like at all.
No.
Some people in the past have basically said that I don't give a wide enough range of marks out of five. Well, I gave this one 1.4. This is the worst I've ever given it, which would leave it down to one. And the only reason why I gave it down to one, because E.E. Doc Smith actually put the end at the end of it. And this was
Got
it.
to the
He
end. That's
actually
pretty
got to the end of it. So I'll give him 1 point for getting to the end of it, but basically nothing else.
Oh, dear.
It's just, oh my God. And then when I go later on, I'll talk about some of the, not talk about, but I'll mention some of the other authors who could possibly have snuck onto this ballot in place of E. Doc Smith, and you'll just shake your head and go, how did the hell did that happen?
I mean, this is reminiscent of Savage Pellucidar, isn't it? Getting onto the ballot,
Exactly. Exactly the
where
same thing.
it's just a sentimental thing by old people who remember the days, good old days of science fiction.
Doc Smith, yeah, he was the one who invented space opera. We love space opera. Let's put that on the ballot. Oh, it's a crock, David. It's just a crock. move on quickly,
well,
please.
We move on from the depths to the heights. How's that?
Oh, okay.
We'll move on to a book called Dune. You may have heard of it. A book called Dune by Frank Herbert. Now, let me start with the good stuff. Dune is one of the classics of the science fiction field. There's no doubt about that. It's now sold many millions of copies and seems likely never to be out of print. But it's interesting that it got off to a very slow start. I was interested to read the afterword to the edition of this that I read. This was the 40th anniversary edition. And it was an afterword written by Brian Herbert, who is Frank Herbert's son. And he documents how difficult his father found it to get the novel published at all. In fact, the first printed edition was put out by a publisher called Chilton Books. And they'd mostly been publishing those great thick automobile repair manuals, you know, these huge things which you've got all the diagrams of how to put the car together again. No other publisher wanted it. And they thought it was far too long at 215,000 words, when most other novels in the science fiction field were only in the 70 to 80,000 word range. Nevertheless, interest in the book started to pick up. It won several awards, as we'll hear. Got a great review in the New York Times, and as they say, the rest is history. Now, when we talked about the first installment of Dune in the magazines, which we talked about in an episode last year, I was pretty critical about it. And that installment published in Analogue was called Dune World. And considering it as a standalone piece of fiction, I found it pretty annoying for all sorts of reasons, which I won't repeat just yet. So the novel includes that segment and adds two other major segments, and those give the story a much better shape. I do have to say that I really enjoyed rereading the whole thing, which is not to say that I don't still have criticisms, because I do. This is the thing about nothing is so perfect that you can't criticize it. So, but anyway, let's try to describe the book. I'll try to describe the plot and keep it short, but it won't be easy because there's a lot in there. So it's set in a future where mankind is spread among the stars, and there are colonies of humans in many different star systems. Somehow, and this is one of the annoyances, which should not get up my nose, this star-traveling advanced civilization has reverted to a system of hereditary monarchy in the form of an emperor. There's a hereditary peerage with dukes and barons and counts. We don't hear much about duchesses, baronesses and countesses, I have to say. And we've got gladiatorial contests too, during which the villains cheat. So there's this weird mix of high-tech and medieval government. We also have the Bene Gesserit, which is a quasi-religious society of women who have been secretly carrying on a generations-long selective breeding program. And many high-born women, including the wives of much of the aristocracy, have been trained up by the Bene Gesserit and have learned various mind-control techniques like the voice, a way of turning an expression so that it's hard for someone to disobey. Or pitching an expression, if you like to say. So the protagonist of the book is young Paul Atreides, who's the son of Duke Leto Atreides. And there's been a long-running bitter feud going on between House Atreides and House Harkonnen for generations. I'm not quite sure that we ever discover why there's been this feud going on. As the story opens, Duke Leto and his entourage are preparing to leave for the planet Arrakis, which is a source of a spice called melange, which helps to extend human life, and so, of course, it's extremely valuable. And the House of Atreides is being sent in to run Arrakis to replace House Harkonnen, who were previously in control there. And this seems like a victory for Atreides, but in fact it's a trap devised by the Harkonnens, who are secretly in league with the Emperor, who fears Duke Leto's popularity among the other great houses, and he wants to destroy him. Now, Arrakis is largely a desert planet, and it's occupied mostly by the Fremen, F-R-E-M-E-N, who are an Arab-like people who somehow manage to survive in incredibly arid conditions in the desert, and they avoid being killed by the giant sandworms which infest the sands. So to cut a very long story short, Duke Leto is betrayed and he dies at the hands of Baron Harkonnen. He dies a different way, but he dies in the hands of the Harkonnens. Paul and his mother Jessica, who is another Bene Gesserit-trained woman, flee into the desert. Here they eventually encounter and are taken in by the Fremen, and through a long series of events, Paul is able to eventually to inflict a terrible revenge on the Harkonnens and the Emperor. What I've left out is that Paul, from his childhood, has felt that he is imbued with a terrible purpose. This phrase occurs dozens of times in the book. I counted. I got sick of seeing it. A terrible purpose. He may be the long-awaited Messiah. He may be the one. Well, spoiler here. Yep, it turns out that he is indeed the one. And he has or requires all sorts of miraculous abilities, including the ability to see the pattern of future events. Oh, and he's also a terrific hand-to-hand fighter. And he's handsome with it. I can see that I'm slipping into being critical. What do I like about it? I like the initial coming-of-age story of Paul Atreides, without the Messiah bit. I like the whole concept of the desert planet, the survival, the trek that Paul and Jessica have to do to survive in the desert, the clever technical idea of the still suits that Freeman wear, which conserve and recycle a body's water, the obsession of the Freeman with conserving every drop of water, and their dream of one day making Arrakis bloom. The secret of the spice and the sandworms. I like the idea of the Spacing Guild, which has a monopoly on space travel. Interesting idea that you'd have some organization which controls all of space travel. Oh, that's very good. It's really interesting material. It's well handled, no question. It's well written. The things I didn't like are really the same as when I talked about the first part of the book last year. The fact that the villain Baron Harkonnen is such an unbelievably cartoony villain. He's this grossly fat schemer with a taste for young boys and who has no redeeming features whatsoever. He's just completely black. There's no shades of grey. And I also really don't much care at all for the whole he's the one storyline of Paul Atreides, who ends it with more names or titles than I can keep track of. He's the Kwisatz Haderach, the one who can be many places at once. The Lisan al-Ghaib, the voice from outside. He's Muad'Dib, the one who points the way. And so on and so on. He stops being a character and becomes this sort of superhuman symbol. And I also get irritated by the statements of the bleeding obvious we get all the time, which are cast in terms as though there's some deep, pious wisdom. A few examples. From the top of the mountain, you cannot see the mountain. Muad'Dib knew that every experience carries its lesson. So the whole book is this feel of trying to be profound and meaningful, but most of this stuff is just banalities. Look, I don't deny that Dune is indeed a great book, classic of the SF genre. I did enjoy rereading it, but it's far from perfect. There you go.
That's fair enough. I think that's a fairly good summary of the whole thing. It's going to get another kick along shortly when the Denis Villeneuve film version is released later in the year, although I'm not terribly sure when that's going to be.
Let's hope it's better than the one with Sting in it.
I believe that this version is only going to take that first section that we dealt with.
Dune World,
yeah, right up until... I think that's right. It might go a little bit further, don't know. But anyway, that's what I think it's going to be going up to. There's one problem in the middle of the... Well, you've pointed out a number of problems, but one major structural problem a little bit in the middle of this, and there's that... There seems to be a big gap of time between the first section and the second, which isn't really explained. It's just hand-waving stuff and nothing happens. Because he just seems... If you read the book, it just carries on and carries on and carries on. It sounds like it's only a couple of months between the time when he's left in the desert, and suddenly there he is. He's the Messiah. How did he get to be this level at that point? And he doesn't seem to age enough to be able to get to that point.
Maybe I think that gap is between the second and third part rather than the first and the second. Okay. The second part is really where he and his mother get through the desert and eventually connect with the Freeman and sort of get involved in that sort of thing. But there is that big gap between the second and the third where suddenly he's the leader, he's the one.
Yeah, things have changed really quickly. And so it'll be very interesting to see how they handle that. Maybe what they've done with the film is taken it up until they hit that part where he actually joins up with the Fremen, and basically then there's a gap, and then they'll do the second part. But we'll find it out later on. It won the Nebula Award as well, but it was only co-winner here of this.
Which I find surprising. But go on, you tell us about the next one.
Yeah, so it's quite strange because it actually won with A novel by, guess who? Roger Zelazny, who seems to be all over this particular podcast today. We keep on mentioning him everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, this book is called And Call Me Conrad, which was later released as the novel This Immortal. Actually, I think And Call Me Conrad is a better title. I think This Immortal is a bit sort of, yeah, really. Published in Fantasy and Science Fiction, October and November 1965. This particular novel, and I read the magazine serialization, because that was, to me, that was the one that was nominated. So that was the one that I read. Now, this particular novel is also included in Gary K. Wolfe's Library of America collection of American science fiction, 8 classic novels of the 1960s.
Uh-huh.
But Dune is not. Now, the reason why Dune is not included in there, as along with a number of other things that were not included, is that firstly, because it was too long. I mean, Dune's just, the, as you said, it's like a really long novel.
More than 200,000 words.
It's far too long to fit in. And also, there were novels by people like Philip K. Dick and Ursula K. Le Guin, which were not included in that list because they already had collections of their own.
Yeah, in the library.
So basically he chose 8 novels that were 8 classic novels from the 1960s that were not included anywhere else. And I'll list those a bit later on so you can get a bit of an idea about where they fit and where this fits. Now, this particular book is set many, many years in the future after a brief nuclear exchange called 3 Days, I think it's called, has rendered most of the mainland territories on Earth radioactive and overrun by mutated life forms. And now there's only 4 million humans left on the planet. So a lot of people have left. They've gone off and gone somewhere else. Earth has been in contact with a blue-skinned alien race from Vega, called the Vegans, as you would expect. That's based on where they come from, not from their dietary requirements. Now, one of these vegans has come to Earth ostensibly to write a travel guide, because of course the vegans, there's a lot more vegans than there are humans. The vegans look on Earth as being a sort of like a strange alien tourist attraction where they go and have a look, and they own parts of it, and they've built resorts, and people come down and travel. And this particular alien wants to write a travel guide, and he commissions the narrator of this particular book, Conrad Nomikos, to act as a tour guide. Now, Conrad is a bit of a strange creature, and I'm not probably going to be able to pronounce this properly, because he gets accused of being this right in the very first paragraph of the book. And he's accused of being a Kalitantzaros, which is a malevolent goblin in southeastern Europe and Anatolian folklore. Now, he also acts a bit like the god Pan. He's got a dodgy leg on one side, and he's got really bad facial scarring down one side of his face. But he's a classic Zelazny hero. Again, as I was talking to us earlier about how he's sort of wisecracking PI type stuff, you know, he's always got an answer for everything. He's always on top of things. He's massively equipped physically, and he's just, you know, he's just a Superman basically. Looks and sounds very much like Zelazny's later character Corwood from the Amber series, which we may talk about at some point further down the track. And so basically Conrad takes this alien through on a wonderful tour all the way right through around through Earth, because Conrad is basically the head of antiquities and on Earth. And one of the things that he's decided to do is he's decided to dismantle the Great Pyramid of Cheops. And when he's asked why, he says, "Oh, well, we're filming it." "Yeah, but why are you dismantling it?" "Oh, well, all the locals want building material, so we're basically pulling it all down so they can use it as building material." And he was like, "This is sacrilege. What the hell are you doing?" And you find out later on that really what he's trying to do is say, "Well, I'm taking it all apart so that when we ran the film backwards, you could see how it was built. Now, this is really funny. I cacked myself when I read this. And what he's doing is he's basically setting up and saying, well, you know, this we're willing to destroy our history rather than let you, the vegans, have it. So just be aware of that, Sunshine. Just be aware of that. Oh, right, okay. Right, so he goes on with this. Now, the setting of the settings really quite good. The plot's interesting. But for me, there's far too much. They get into a lot of scrapes along the way, this group. They all go together. You think first off it's just the vegan and the Conrad got together, but somehow or other there's like half a dozen people there.
Yeah.
At least one or two of them that are trying to kill either Conrad or the vegan or both. And although Conrad decides that he really doesn't like the vegan and doesn't like what he's doing, he decides that he's going to act as his protector to make sure that he gets through, because he wants to show him that we own this place and you are not going to take it off us. But there are far too many just in the nick of time coincidences in the plot that allows just about ready to get slaughtered. Oh, the cavalry turns up and saves him.
That's exactly right. It happens at least twice.
Three times. The dog that he hasn't seen for 15 years just happens to turn up within 5 seconds of the fact of he's going to be dead. On, mate.
It's a bit too much. I thought that was too much. I liked it.
It was funny. It was interesting, but it's not up to the standard of Dune by any stretch of the imagination.
No, certainly not.
I can't work out why the people decided to vote it as the same thing. Maybe a lot of people decided that Dune was just too long and just didn't want to read it. I don't know. But basically, it was interesting. So didn't get a nomination at all for the for the Nebula Awards, by the way, this particular novel, which is interesting.
Yeah. No, I didn't like it much at all. I read it and I quite enjoyed reading it, as you say, but it came to nothing in the end. And the whole reason why this alien is there turns out to be okay. The other thing I couldn't get out of it, I didn't understand from it, is why he's immortal. I mean, who he really is and why he turns out to be some sort of immortal. It's pretty clear that he is immortal and that he's been around since the days of the Greek gods in legend.
Yep.
And you say he was he might be the Greek god Pan. I also thought he might be the god Hephaestus, you know, the blacksmith, because I think he has a crook leg in the stories too. Whatever he is, but why he's still there and what that's got to do with the story, I'm not entirely sure.
It's opaque to me. It's just a weird... Anyway, it's just weird.
Yeah.
All right. So a couple of suggestions for things, novels that might have appeared on the ballot. We have... A lot of these are from various things. First off, what I'll do is I'll talk about that American science fiction, 8 classic novels of the 1960s, so that you can see where it fits in. So he chose The High Crusade, which won a Hugo, which we discussed, by Paul Anderson. Way Station by Clifford Simak, also won a Hugo in 1964, which we discussed. Good. Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah, good.
Yep. And this one, and Call Me Conrad by Roger Zelazny. Past Master by R.A. Lafferty.
Yeah, I don't think I've read that.
Now, I haven't read that, but I've been reading a bit more short fiction by R.A. Lafferty lately, I'm starting to get a lot more of an appreciation for his stuff.
Yeah, he was a good one.
And which I never had previously. Picnic on Paradise by Joanna Russ, which I've read. It's very interesting. Nova by William Burroughs.
William Burroughs, gosh, okay.
Yeah, so that's where the Nova Mob gets its title from, I believe. Really? And a Jack Vance novel called Inferio.
Inferior, which is supposed to be his best novel. It's the one I haven't read yet.
I will
get to it. Yeah. Inferior is something I must read. Yeah, Rob Durant said it was his best.
All right. Now, the other possible nominations for this particular year, maybe I should have done the other way around, but it doesn't matter. Well, fair enough. Star Fox by Paul Anderson. That was the one that was the make, the fix-up from the
Mark and Reprise.
Mark and Reprise. Nova Express by William S. Burroughs. Dr. Blood Money by Philip K. Dick. The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch by Philip K. Dick.
Great stuff. Either
of those two could have gone on instead of the bloody Doc Smith book. The Genocides by Tom Dish. Don't know. The Ship That Sailed the Time Stream by G.C. Edmondson. A Plague of Demons by Keith Laumer. All Flesh Is Grass by Clifford Cumas, which you really like, I believe.
Yeah, well, it's a good Simak novel. Yeah.
Yeah. The Clone, Ted Thomas and Kate Wilhelm. And The Escape Orbit by James White. So, look, there was a lot of more interesting stuff. I mean, I can understand why Dune was on it.
Oh, sure.
On the list. And that's really it. I mean, I don't, from what you said, The Squares of the City, Moon is a Harsh Mistress, shouldn't have been on it because it should have been in 67, which it ends up being in 67 and then wins for that. Skylark, nah. And Call Me Conrad, nah. It's interesting, but nah, it's not that good.
No, it's not an award winner.
No, not an award winner. So, June's the real standout here, above and beyond everything else, I think.
Yeah, there's no question that it is a great novel. I've been critical of it, but it is still a good book.
It's that book, that one of those books that if people have read anything in the science fiction field, they would have read that, and it'll be all over the place coming up when the new film version comes out. And I think that if people haven't read it for a while, I'd suggest that it's probably a good one to go back and read before the film version is released, so that you get a bit of an idea about what's going on. Both of my children tried to read this book, and neither of them liked it.
Neither of them liked it?
Nope, did not like it at all.
No, fair enough.
And so that's an interesting point, that maybe it's for old white guys like you and me, David, that you need to be of that age to remember how bad the other science fiction was. And if you read the E. Doc Smith, then you really do know how bad it was.
In comparison.
It was just, I mean, it's chalk and cheese, it really is. I mean, the Herbert, it's always chosen amongst the top SF novels of all time, if not the SF novel of all time, although I don't necessarily think that it is. Although I wouldn't like to, off the top of my head, pick the one that was, but it's certainly in the discussion.
Probably Le Guin, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, yes, I think probably right, either Dispossessed or The Left Hand of Darkness. I think probably one of those two. So we could get into a really long discussion here, David.
We won't. No,
that's a rabbit hole we don't want to go down. So I think we're about done here, David.
I think so, yeah.
I think we're just about finished, so...
we'll leave it at that. And next episode, we're going to be just back to talking about what we've been reading lately.
Reading, watching, listening to, that sort of stuff.
A
couple of things that I want to chat about, which we don't normally chat about. So there's one particular new podcast that I've been listening to when I'm driving around that I think people will find very, very interesting. So it's good. All right. Okay, David.
Right. Catch you later.
Thanks very much.
See you in a couple of weeks. Well, I'll see you probably earlier than that, but we'll talk in another couple of weeks.
Yep. Okay, sounds good. Thanks, David.
Ciao.